From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The war of words between North Korea and the United States continues to escalate. In his latest comments, Kim Jong-un said President Trump will pay dearly for his UN speech this week, in which he threatened to totally destroy the North if the U.S. is forced to defend itself against Kim's nuclear weapons. Kim also called President Trump a mentally deranged dotard. Dotard means a person in a feeble or childish state due to old age. Jim Walsh is Here and Now security analyst. He's with MIT's Security Studies Program, and he joins us in the studio. Hi, Jim.
How are you?
I'm doing well. And the BBC describes what Kim said about President Trump as an unprecedented personal statement. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I was online late last night with colleagues who study North Korea, many of them who've studied it longer than I have, and that's in my case, that's 15 years. And they were very struck by this. That sent off a lot of flashing red lights for them. It was personalized. He was speaking in the first person. He was giving a public address, and basically he's taking ownership of these threats. It's not the North Korean government issuing him. It's not the North Korean military. It's the chairman. And that is unusual.
And what about President Trump's response, calling Kim a madman and saying he'll be tested like never before?
Well, I just don't know what that gets you. I think my own view is Kim is more calculating than crazy. But if you thought he was crazy, is it a good idea to call a crazy person crazy? You know, I just don't know what the strategy is there.
Well, the U.S. yesterday announced new sanctions against North Korea. This has been the strategy all along, is to try to increase economic sanctions and put pressure on the North. But is there any hope that new sanctions are going to do anything that previous sanctions have not?
Well, certainly not in a time frame that would matter. So when you're imposing sanctions, you say, I'm going to hurt you, and I expect you to change your behavior. But the question is, when? Is it going to be tomorrow? Is it going to be a year from now? Is it going to be 5 years from now? Well, I can tell you in a year they'll have a lot more missiles and more nuclear tests. So we seem to have a disconnect. They seem to be able to build missiles faster than we can impose sanctions that would somehow impede that.
We've also been talking as a country about our ability to shoot down North Korean missiles, although you would wonder, if we have that ability, why haven't we been shooting them down when they shoot them over Japan, for example?
Well, I think there's a real question whether we have that ability. And I've had this conversation with friends. So look at what that world looks like. They shoot a missile, and then one of two things happens. Either we miss, and sort of all the extended deterrence, all our reassurance to our allies, the Japanese and the South Koreans, they wake up the next morning thinking, oh my God, we're not defended. Or it works, and then the pressure is to shoot down every one of them.
Right.
And then you will eventually miss, which brings you back to step one.
One of the things that the U.S. has been saying is that China needs to do more. China and Russia are urging restraint from both sides. Could these two countries do anything concrete to tamp this down?
Yes, and you'll notice that President Trump threw a bone to both of them, thanking them in his UN speech for what they had done. Allegedly, or at least Mr. Trump has reported that the Chinese have agreed to cut off all banking to North Korean customers. You know, based on my team's interviews with North Korean defectors, I think the North Koreans are simply going to do a countermeasure, the same one they've always used, which is they'll just hire private Chinese companies to do the work for them. And so that's where I think the Chinese really need to get more active, is going after Chinese firms that are doing all the work for the North Koreans.
The North Korean foreign minister said that North Korea could test a hydrogen bomb in the Pacific. If they were to do that, would it require a military response from the U.S.?
Well, it wouldn't require it. I mean, you know, the devil's in the details here. The U.S., France, Britain, we all conducted above-ground nuclear testing for years and years back in the day. You know, if they have a test that's way out in the middle of the ocean and no one gets hurt, you know, is that really a justification for nuking them or attacking them or launching a missile that then turns into a broader war? I think that becomes a very difficult decision.
You know, after President Trump used his famous fire and fury language on North Korea, we then learned that, in fact, there were some behind-the-scenes negotiations going on between the U.S. and North Korea. Do you think that's happening here, too?
Well, I certainly hope so. Unfortunately, there have been several pronouncements, some out of the White House and some out of Japan, saying the time for talking is over. It seems to me when things are really, really delicate and there are a lot of moving parts and someone can make a mistake, that's actually the time you want to be talking to people. That's when you need to be talking to people, if only to protect your own self-interest. They have had talks in the past. That's how Otto Warmbier got home. I would hope that they are continuing to have conversations so that no one makes a mistake here.
Scale of 1 to 10, Jim, how worried are you right now about the situation?
I'm more worried. I'm more worried. I'm not going to give you a number.
Okay. That's Jim Walsh, here now security analyst with the MIT Security Studies Program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
More is key. They're more worried. Well, New York's Governor Cuomo is traveling on a donated JetBlue plane to Puerto Rico in what is said to be the first airline to land in San Juan since Hurricane Maria ravaged the U.S. territory. Maria knocked out the entire power grid, most communications. Streets are flooded or blocked by debris. And Puerto Ricans like 31-year-old Angelica Garcia have no hope of going to the island soon. Angelica recently graduated from medical school in the Dominican Republic. She's in Boston doing medical rotations, and she's trying to reach her family on the western part of Puerto Rico. She joins us now in the studio. Angelica, have you been able to make any contact at all?
No. It's been almost 3 days with no communication.
Where are they and who are they? Who's there?
My mom is with my grandmother, my aunt, and my uncle. They were in the same house to wait for the hurricane. So they're in the town of Aguada, is in the western part of the island. And what I know from Facebook and all the media is that they haven't been able to communicate. They don't have any way to know from any town in the western area. Mm-hmm. We don't know if they're okay. We don't know. I know they don't have power. They don't have any way to communicate.
Well, and you were communicating before the storm hit.
Yeah.
And know that, you've got real concerns about your mother's health.
Yes, I do. Also, my grandma. My mother is insulin dependent. And last time when Irma hit, she had ice for, it lasted her like 4 days.
And ice, we should say, to keep the insulin.
To keep the insulin, yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And it just lasted for 4 days and is already day four almost. And she's not the only one, of course. There's a lot of diabetic people and people, asthmatic people, depending on machines and all that.
Yeah, that's just terrible.
And we just really need medical attention to that people in the western area, because a friend I have tried to go there and drive from San Juan, but he wasn't able to because the roads are blocked.
So this has got to be a terrible feeling. How are you handling this?
Well, it's really hard. It's really, you just feel this anxiety and you can, we're just like texting and using Facebook and talking to all the other Puerto Ricans that are outside. We're really trying to keep it together.
Yeah.
And just saying it. Everything's going to be fine, but we know it's not going to be fine. They really need help right now. I mean, what I've read, all the interviews I've seen from people from the area near San Juan, and what they managed to do already, the damage is so extensive. I mean, completely still buildings are torn apart, and the power is going to be out for months. And to rebuild an island is just so complicated. It's going to be so hard.
Yeah. Well, and of course, your immediate concerns are, how are they doing? Look, we'll try to get through too. And can't imagine that one of the first things you will want to do with your new medical school background is go there.
Right now, they haven't really explained if they need voluntary people to go there, but I would love that if they need it, we can organize groups. I know a lot of Puerto Ricans are going to, and not Puerto Ricans, they just want to help. They're going to be willing to really go and put their time and effort into just helping.
Yeah. And I want to note for people who aren't as familiar with diabetes, if your mother's insulin fails or she runs out, she can't eat without the insulin.
I don't really know what's going to happen. We never expected this to be so huge. I mean, we had hurricanes in the past. The worst hurricane I experienced myself was Hurricane George. And I think it was 1998 when that hit. It was really bad. But this, they can't compare this to Maria. Maria was something like so powerful, and it just hit in the middle of the island. They were trying to get ready for it, but it was right after Irma. They were just getting back to normal, and this happened. So we were also in the medical field concerned about all the implications this might bring, like mosquito diseases, and that's really powerful.
Well, it's already shut off the electricity that pumps water for drinking water, and so... Angelica Garcia, again, visiting Boston, can't reach her family in Puerto Rico. We just, thank you so much for really bringing home how hard this has hit. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Uber could be out of one of the world's largest cities after a ruling today. London's transport authority says it will not renew Uber's license, saying it has demonstrated a lack of corporate responsibility with public safety and security implications. Uber has 40,000 drivers in London, and it's used by 3.5 million passengers there. Joining us from London is BBC Business reporter Theo Leggett. Theo, why this decision from Transport for London?
Well, Transport for London says it's been looking at the way Uber's been operating and has serious concerns about it. The first area of concern is, it says, Uber's approach to reporting serious criminal offences. Well, what does that mean? The London Metropolitan Police wrote a letter recently suggesting that Uber was not reporting all the crimes allegedly committed by its drivers, or all the allegations made against its drivers, I should say, particularly when it came to things like sexual assault, and that there were fears that because of that, drivers who'd committed one offence might then commit another. Now, this is something that Uber denies, and it also says it's not its responsibility to report potential crimes. It's up to the victim of that crime to report it to the police. Nevertheless, that has caused controversy. It also says it's concerned about Uber's approach to getting medical certificates for its drivers and obtaining their criminal records. And there's one other area which it's worried about as well, which is Uber's use of software known as Greyball. Now, this is a software application developed by Uber to filter out passengers it didn't want to carry in Uber cabs, so troublesome passengers. But there are concerns, there have been concerns voiced in other cities around the world, that Uber might be using this to obstruct regulators, to stop regulators being able to carry out spot checks on Uber operators. There's no evidence it's actually done that in London, but the London Transport Authority, Transport for London, says it hasn't explained its approach to Greyball properly, so that's a point of concern.
And what is Uber saying in response to all of this today?
Well, Uber's come out fighting. It says Transport for London and the London mayor have caved in to a small number of people who want to restrict consumer choice. What does it mean by that? Well, since it arrived in London in 2012, Uber has faced intense opposition from London's black cab operators, who have to spend several years training and doing an exam called the Knowledge before they're allowed to operate in London, so they have high costs.
Because
they
especially like before there was GPS, the London taxi drivers had to know every single street in London, so that if somebody asked them to take them to a specific address, they would know where to go.
Absolutely. They had to spend time doing this exam known as the Knowledge. They had to demonstrate that they knew London streets. And they're not very happy about being undercut by drivers who are simply relying on a GPS. But also established minicab drivers as well. They don't like the way Uber operates. So there is this entrenched opposition. And Uber's view is that the London authorities have simply caved in to those vested interests.
And is there also a question of conflict of interest here? Because Transport for London is sort of a competitor to Uber at this point, running the tube and the buses.
Well, that depends on your point of view. No doubt people will make that accusation. What Transport for London itself says is that it's not against technology. It's not against new types of transport services. What it's concerned about is that it says that Uber hasn't been playing by the rules. The rules are there for everybody and Uber has to abide by them. If it doesn't, it's not considered a fit and proper holder of a private hire operator license, a taxi license. Therefore, it can't have one.
In this country, Uber faced some problems, similar problems in Austin, Texas. They went away for a while, but then eventually they came back. I wonder, is the sense that Uber is actually going to be kicked out of London or that at some point they'll reach an agreement?
Personally, I'd be very surprised if Uber was kicked out of London. And they have to appeal to begin with. They've got 21 days in which to launch an appeal, and we know they're going to do that. While that appeal is going through, they can continue to operate, and then they can challenge in the courts if they need to. Now, Uber has had legal problems with various versions of its service and its app around the world. And generally speaking, what's happened is it's adapted its service to meet with the requirements of regulators. So although it's come out with a very belligerent statement today, said it's doing nothing wrong, and that the authorities are caving into vested interests, what I think is likely to happen behind the scenes is that there will be negotiations and that some kind of solution will be found that allows Uber to keep operating, allows the 40,000 drivers in London who operate Uber services to keep on offering those services.
That's BBC Business reporter Theo Leggett in London. Theo, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Well, season four of the Amazon original series Transparent drops today. The show stars Jeffrey Tambor as Maura Pfefferman, a retired professor who comes out late in life as a transgender woman.
I'm sorry, Dad. I'm sorry. I'm just trying. Can you just help me out here? Are you saying that you're going to start dressing up like a lady all the time?
Honey, all my life. My whole life I've been dressing up like a man. This is me.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
So the show's first three seasons told the story of Maura and her family adjusting to her midlife transition. How are things playing out in season four?
Well, it's interesting. So that earlier clip that was played gives us a sense of how Maura Pfefferman sort of viewed her life. What we see in season four is we see flashbacks to the time when Maura was younger and was going by Morty Pfefferman and was struggling with this, was looking into a mirror, for example, and seeing a woman staring back at him, even though he was dressed like a man and still passing as a man. And so we get to see a lot of flashbacks to give us a sense of who he saw himself as internally and who he had to present himself as to the world. And that's something that we're seeing a lot in season four. Also, there's this interesting storyline where there's a revelation in the history of Maura's family that winds up seeing the whole family go to Israel together to tour sites in Israel. And if you know how dysfunctional this family is, you can anticipate what a ride that's going to be. There's a great scene where Maura is going through security and gets tripped up because she's still in transition. Let's check it out.
You've got a groin anomaly.
I'm sorry, what?
A groin anomaly.
What's happening, Mom?
Back up, ma'am.
What's going on? Why are you hassling her?
I have a groin anomaly. May I talk to you? I'm trans. Do you understand what that is?
Oh, then we're going to need a male agent. Mac?
Yeah. Hi, Matt. I can't pat her down. You need to pat her down.
I can't pat her down.
Well, she's a woman, right?
Well...
See, that's one of the strengths of Transparent is that they often show how things that might be routine for people who are not transgender can become really embarrassing public incidents right. for people who are trans because the rest of society hasn't caught up yet.
Eric, I watched the first couple of seasons of Transparent and it was interesting. Sometimes it was sort of a comedy and sometimes it got really serious and even depressing. How do they deal with that in season four?
It's very much that now, because this is really the story of a really self-centered and unlikable on some level group of people who are in the same family. And what we see in season four is that Maura has gotten to the nub of why she lived the life that she lived, and she's trying to live a more authentic life. All these other characters are trying to live a more authentic life too, but they're struggling. And so sometimes that's funny, but sometimes that's very tragic. And as viewers, you always toggle between being kind of repulsed and angered and irritated by what they're doing and also responding to the human element of it, which is you know, these people are in pain and they've developed these weird coping mechanisms for it. And you're also learning a lot about subcultures, especially trans culture, and Mara is sort of leading us through that.
The show has been criticized for not casting a transgender actor in the lead role. Jeffrey Tambor addressed that criticism in his Emmy's acceptance speech last year. Let's listen.
To you people out there, you producers and you network owners, please give transgender talent a chance. Give them audition. I would not be unhappy were I the last cisgender male to play a female transgender on television.
What do you make of Tambor's performance as a non-transgender or cisgender actor in this role?
He's done an amazing job and has been nominated for and won pretty significant awards in the role. When the show was first being introduced to the world, I think they were in a situation where they needed to have an actor who had something of a name. So, having somebody like Tambor, who was well-known in comedy circles, doing a dramatic role that, required a lot from him, that was a way to sort of draw attention to the show in its early, in its first season and, when it was first introduced. And the show itself features a transgender actress, Alexandra Billings, and she gets featured a lot in season 4. We see her relationship with a man kind of fall apart, and we're intimately sort of drawn into her life. So she gets a lot of showcase time, and viewers and producers can get to see what a transgender actor can do with a role where they're playing a transgender person. And I'm hoping that will help give transgender actors more opportunities to play these kind of characters.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking with us about Transparent, which is back today with its 4th season. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
So what does it mean that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced his company will cooperate more with Congress and create new steps to prevent foreign governments from using Facebook to meddle in elections?
I wish I could tell you that we're going to be able to stop all interference, but that just wouldn't be realistic. There will always be bad actors in the world, and we can't prevent all governments from all interference. But we can make it harder. We can make it much harder.
Well, Facebook has been under scrutiny since it acknowledged that it sold ad time to 500 Russian-linked accounts during the campaign on issues that supported candidate Trump. Yesterday, the company also said it's handing over the contents of more than 3,000 ads believed to be linked to Russia's attacks on the election. Michael Regan is a senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us. And Michael, your thoughts on these announcements?
Well, it's interesting. Obviously, at first, Facebook didn't want to share a lot of detailed information. The company's policy is basically to only provide information to the government if there's a valid court order or a subpoena or a search warrant. But it clearly had a change of heart after reviewing all its legal options. And it has been providing special counsel Robert Mueller with details, as you said, on more than 3,000 political ads that were linked to Russia. Mm-hmm. The Senate Intelligence Committee is talking about bringing in representatives of the company to discuss it further.
Yeah. Well, and Facebook, like any social media company, tech company, they don't like to hand over too much data. What your sense of how this is going to impact the company and its users?
Well, I think a lot depends on how regulators respond. The problem with their ad system is that it's sort of automatic. You don't have to interact with a sales rep. So as currently set up, it's easy for people to get in and place ads like this. And it also has, obviously, this very big problem with fake news. Our Bloomberg Businessweek magazine has a really interesting cover story on this whole political climate around Facebook. It talks about how there was fake news saying that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump and that sort of thing. So it's really sort of two different problems it has to address going forward. And it's not an easy thing to solve.
As we said, Zuckerberg announced there's going to be a plan to prevent foreign governments from interfering. One of the ideas would be to disclose when the ad pops up on your Facebook page. You'll have to disclose which page paid for it. So in other words, you can click through the ad and find out what.
Right. Find out who's actually paying for it, what some of their other ads are. bringing a lot more transparency to political advertising on Facebook, much like is done on television and print ads. And the idea is at least to discourage the type of thing that appears to have happened in the last election.
Well, but how do you do that? I mean, some of these fake companies, you know, with Russian links are so buried, they're bots. How do you do that?
It's going to be a very difficult thing to do. They're talking about bringing in about 250 employees to work on this. There's been suggestions from some people that they have humans actually read every post on the site, and that obviously would be very difficult to do. But I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how regulators sort of direct them and not just on this, but on any trust issues as well.
Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Michael, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Leaders from around the world are in New York this week for the United Nations General Assembly. We've heard some of the headlines about President Trump's activities there, but we want to take a few minutes now to listen to what some of the other world leaders have been saying, starting with Gaston Alfonso Brown, the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda. He described the devastation on those islands because of the recent hurricanes.
For the first time in over 300 years, there is now no permanent resident on Barbuda. The footprints of an entire civilization have been emasculated by the brutality and magnitude of Irma. Everything that meant anything to the inhabitants had to be left behind. Their homes, their possessions, their history. Indeed, everything that defines them as a society and as a people. Mercifully, Antigua, the larger of the two islands, suffered no major damage, and it could begin function normally within 48 hours. Had that not been the case, Mr. President, how we would have coped is simply beyond imagination. Overnight, Antigua's population increased by almost 3%. I know of no country that could easily cope with such an unplanned, unexpected, and unscheduled increase in its population. In addition to providing shelter and accommodation and basic necessities to the evacuated residents of Barbuda, the social services on Antigua are now under great strain. Under great strain to provide school places for an additional 600 students, medical services for the elderly, and a means of income for the able-bodied. Naturally, the residents of Barbuda are anxious to return to their homeland. But as I speak to you, the island remains unfit for human habitation. There's no electricity, no potable water, and 95% of the buildings have been destroyed or severely damaged.
The president of Guatemala also spoke. Jimmy Morales addressed migration and had a specific message for the government of the U.S. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
Together with our partners here, we have acted to stimulate the economy and improve security so that migration can be reduced, as well as the risk faced by migrants and embarking on their dangerous journey to improve their quality of life. We therefore set much store by the endeavors of all members of the UN in negotiating a global pact for safe, regular, and orderly migration, which, as a UN mechanism, puts priority on the capacity, work, and contribution of migrants, regardless of their status. In accordance with our need to deal with our aid our fellow citizens, we have extended our consular staff in the U.S. in order to promote and protect the human rights of migrants in the U.S. and provide consular services in a way that is closer to the people. Here I wish to refer to our so-called young dreamers, who today are part of the group which contributes with its talent, knowledge, and work to the development of the communities where they live. Like other countries who have dreamers falling under the shelter of the DACA program, Guatemala hopes that the sentiment of humanity of the U.S. people and regional solidarity of the U.S. government will flourish, so that over the next few months we will see the Senate passing legislation to allow this group of young people and children to enjoy legal status in the U.S.
The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, had harsh words for North Korea's provocative actions, but his speech also had a thinly veiled criticism of President Trump.
The use of nuclear weapons should be unthinkable. Even the threat of their use can never be condoned. But today, global anxieties about nuclear weapons are at the highest level since the end of the Cold War. And the fear is not abstract. Millions of people live under a shadow of dread cast by the provocative nuclear and missile tests of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And within the DPRK itself, such tests do nothing to ease the plight of those who are suffering hunger and severe violations of their human rights. I condemn those tests unequivocally. And I call on the DPRK and all member states to fully comply with Security Council resolutions. Last week's unanimous adoption of Resolution 2375 tightens sanctions and sends a clear message regarding the country's international obligations. I appeal to the Council to maintain its unity. Only that unity can lead to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and, as the resolution recognizes, create an opportunity for diplomatic engagement to resolve the crisis. When tensions rise, so does the chance of miscalculation. Fiery talk can lead to fatal misunderstandings. The solution must be political, and this is a time for statesmanship. We must not sleepwalk our way into war.
Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, the Emir of Qatar, used his time to criticize neighboring countries that have imposed a blockade on Qatar. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
The blockade was imposed abruptly and without warning, prompting Qataris to consider it a kind of betrayal. It seems that those who have planned and implemented it had envisaged that their move would cause a shocking and direct impact that will bring the state of Qatar to its knees and to capitulate to a total guardianship imposed upon it. And what is worse, the blockade schemers found it necessary to rely on fabricated quotes attributed to me, which they posted on the website of Qatar News Agency after hacking it. The controlled media of these countries was ready to launch an all-out campaign of incitement prepared in advance, in which all values, morals and norms were breached, and the truth was infringed upon by a torrent of lies. Funds are still being spent unsparingly on the machine, faking and disseminating fabrications in the hope of fooling people by distorting the truth with mere lies.
One more speech we want to listen to, the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, who took an unusual turn in his speech to criticize his own country. He said the government of Canada had not treated the Indigenous people fairly.
There are Indigenous parents in Canada who say goodnight to their children and have to cross their fingers in the hopes that their kids won't run away or take their own lives in the night. Young Indigenous people in Canada struggle to get a good education, and though residential schools are thankfully a thing of the past, too many Indigenous youth are still sent far away, far from their families, just to get the basic education most Canadians take for granted. And far, far too many Indigenous women live in Canada a life that includes threats of violence so frequent and severe that Amnesty International has called it a human rights crisis. That is the legacy of colonialism in Canada, of a paternalistic Indian Act, of the forced relocation of Inuit and First Nations communities, and a systematic denial of Métis rights and history, of residential schools that separated children as young as 5 years old from their families, punished them for speaking their own language, and sought to extinguish Indigenous cultures entirely. The good news is that Canadians get it. They see the inequities, and they're fed up with the excuses. And that impatience gives us a rare and precious opportunity to act.
Some excerpts of speeches from the United Nations General Assembly this week.
Tomorrow, the Catholic Church will beatify a priest from Okarchee, Oklahoma, the first step towards sainthood. Three people murdered Father Stanley Rother in Guatemala in 1981 during that country's civil war. Last year, Pope Francis declared Rother a martyr, setting the stage for him to become a saint. Jacob McClellan from member station KGOU reports.
Wayne Ludwig stands outside Holy Trinity Catholic Church in Okarchee, Oklahoma, following a Saturday afternoon mass while cicadas sing nearby. Ludwig grew up down the road from Father Stanley Rother in this postcard flat farming town of 1,200 people, northwest of Oklahoma City.
I remember when he come up from Guatemala. One time he come up and got an old red pickup and had all kinds of old antique farm machinery, and he took off back down there for those people to use. And that's just the kind of guy he was. He kind of helped as he went.
Stanley Rother had farming in his blood, and friends thought he would eventually run the family farm. Instead, he chose the priesthood. He went to seminary in San Antonio, Texas, but he struggled with Latin. He failed his first year and was sent home. He later finished seminary in Maryland and was ordained. In 1968, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City sent Rother to Guatemala to serve as a missionary in the community of Santiago Atitlan. Among the people he worked with was Juan Pablo Ixbalan. Speaking on Skype with a translator, Ixbalan says Rother gained trust from his parishioners by learning how to speak Spanish and the local Mayan language, Sutuhil. He started a radio station, a health clinic, and nutrition programs. He introduced farmers to new crops like wheat, carrots, tomatoes, radishes, and other vegetables. Santiago Atitlan was a poor community, and the violent Guatemalan civil war took a heavy toll. Guerrilla fighters hid in the surrounding mountains and tried to recruit town members. Government soldiers occupied Santiago Atitlan and kidnapped or killed anyone who is suspected of fighting for the rebels. Rother's church was a sanctuary for those who feared for their lives. Ixbalan says Father Rother gave watches to farmers. He told them to leave the fields by 4 o'clock and go home. Otherwise, government soldiers would get suspicious they were working with the rebels. He also invited soldiers to come to Mass. That way, he says, the soldiers could see the people weren't guerrilla fighters, but were there in peace.
In one of his letters, he said, just to shake the hand of a local indigenous person, Zutuhil, is considered being a traitor.
Maria Scaparlanda is a writer and journalist who wrote a biography about Stanley Rother. She says he personally searched for the bodies of the disappeared. He set up a fund for widows and children of victims, an act he knew the government would consider subversive. He ended up on a death list.
It wasn't unusual for different priests to be on death list, but being an American on a death list was a big deal.
Rother briefly left Guatemala and returned to Oklahoma, but he was restless. He wanted to be with the imperiled community he had served for 13 years.
One of the images that he used a lot in his letters was to say, the shepherd cannot run at the first sign of danger. And in another letter, he said, the shepherd cannot leave his sheep.
I had a good idea by that time in our lives that there was no way that I would be able to convince him not to go.
That's Stanley Rother's sister, Marita. She's now a nun in Wichita, Kansas.
But, you know, you try. The last time that I spoke with him, it was just in a matter of just saying, you know, are you sure this is what you need to do? And he said, well, I think it is. I know that it is.
Father Rother returned to Santiago Huatitlan in 1981. Months later, three men broke into the rectory. They shot and killed him. The following day, people filled the plaza outside the church. Community leaders in Santiago Huatitlan had one request. His body could be buried in Oklahoma, but they wanted his heart to be kept in the church. His family agreed. Pope Francis declared Stanley Rother a martyr last year. Tomorrow's beatification ceremony in Oklahoma City will be the final step before possible canonization as a saint. Oklahoma City Archbishop Paul Coakley says beatification is a formal declaration that someone lived a life worthy of imitation. But Coakley says the road to sainthood isn't over yet.
I mean, quite literally, it will take a miracle, because that's what the church requires for somebody to be canonized as a saint.
Archbishop Coakley says a miracle usually comes by way of a person with an incurable disease who has exhausted medical care and asks for intercession from somebody like Stanley Rother. If the favor is granted and the disease is cured, a medical tribunal will investigate.
If there is no medical explanation, scientific explanation for the healing that the person has experienced and received, applying the very rigorous medical tests to that, it could be declared a miracle. And that's what will be required for Blessed Stanley to become Saint Stanley.
Juan Pablo Ixbalan, the man who worked with Father Rother in Guatemala, says it would be an honor for the priest to be canonized. But to him, personally, Rother is already a saint for everything he gave to his community. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob McClelland.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.